This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. You are listening to Afternoons. On today's episode, we were talking student loans with $1.6 trillion owed in the US and the UK really not that far behind. Is university worth the financial woes? We spoke to Steve Cronin of Dead Simple Saving. And could a bit of insider knowledge score you some financial aid, a scholarship, or a bit of extra help? Sarai from Crimson Education giving her insider info. Plus, with summer upon us and routines well and truly out of the window for many families, what can we do to help regulate our kids, their moods, and of course, discussions around screen time too. We're in conversation with a flood prevention and sustainability expert in light of the project that has been announced here in the UAE for the future. And it was ice baths that are currently under scrutiny, with deaths being related to the Wim Hof method. What do you need to know before you take the plunge? Today we are diving into a critical topic that affects millions of people worldwide. Student loans. Now, the journey of student loans has evolved significantly from its early beginnings to present day, and impacting, of course, how students access and afford higher education. The total amount of outstanding student loan debt in the US as of Q4 last year was $1.6 trillion. Talking soaring college costs, pressure to compete as well in the job marketplace, really big factors here. And recently a New York Times article highlighted a concerning trend that over 20% of student loans in the US are currently in non-payment. But we're also seeing this internationally as well. We are going to be exploring a little bit around the trends, the future outlook of student loans globally, and also asking, is university worth it? When we start looking at your pros and cons, your P&L. So lots to consider. To guide us through the topic, we have got independent financial coach of Dead Simple Saving and father, we should say, Steve Cronin. How are you, Steve?
Hello, I'm good. Although my head is spinning with the complications of student loans right now.
It's wild, isn't it? I have very mixed feelings about university right now, to be truthful, because I look at my kids and I'm like, that's a lot of money, girls. Are you going to do what I did, which was basically socialise for 3 years? And what kind of return on investment do you get for those kind of fees? So it's really, really complicated. And we were just hearing there from Soraya talking about, you know, financial aid and scholarships and, you know, those kind of options. But I wanted to ask you, perhaps, maybe you can give us a bit of an overview on the kind of the current state of student loans globally, but, you know, crucially how they do impact students and families. You know, many families struggling with the decision whether to save for education or take out loans. So what do you need to consider?
Well, firstly, some people are lucky enough to have enough cash that they can just pay for their children's education. In the UK, for example, the tuition fees are £9,250. And then every month that the student is there, on average, it's costing about £1,070. So we're looking at about £12,000, £13,000 a month for maintenance. That's about £20,000 total per year. And that's not if you're living in London, then it's going to be even more. So it is an expensive prospect. If you have enough cash to just pay for that, then great. If you your child can also work and be employed during university. I'm not a massive fan of this, but because I think it distracts from studies, but they can also fund it themselves. Or you can just say, you know what, you're on your own and you're gonna have this debt. So rather than the parents taking out a personal loan, the child takes out a student loan, and that probably works out more efficiently in terms of interest rates over time, but it means that you leave university saddled with thousands and thousands of debt. I mean, from what we've just been talking about, that would be like £60,000 that you could be emerging with, which is pretty scary.
And now looking at, you know, longer repayments, you can have people leaving university and still paying it off into their 50s and 60s. I paid mine off about 7 years ago. So I was like in my mid-30s when I finished paying off my student loan. And, you know, I don't mind saying my parents, you know, provided money towards some aspects of university, but I took on that loan myself and I worked in the evenings in, you know, in a restaurant to kind of supplement my partying lifestyle. But it's not a great thing to leave university, as you say, saddled with debt when you really should be thinking about building a life and earning. It's and can we come back to that point about interest, though? Because that, I think that is a very valid one. My dad's philosophy was, well, you know, it's a free loan, effectively. What are interest rates like? And let's look at the UK in particular when it comes to student loans, Steve. Do you have any numbers?
I do. I mean, it's definitely not a free loan.
Sorry, Dad.
So, I mean, in the UAE, a personal loan is going to be, you know, kind of 7%-ish if you're lucky, right? So that's quite high. In the UK, interest rates were 6.25%. So if you started university before 2012, you're paying about 6.25%. If you started after that date, it's anything up to 7.9%. Mm. And these rates can vary over time. So that's pretty high. I mean, if you look at what you can make in the stock market, that's about 7% long-term average. And I typically say that expensive debt is anything well over 5%, and that you should focus on paying down any expensive debt before you start investing big chunks in the stock market. Mm. So this is actually in the expensive debt category. The only difference is that you only start paying off the debt once you earn above a certain threshold. And those thresholds are different for the UK, working in the UK versus working in the UAE. So if you're going to graduate and then move back to the UAE, or if you're working in the UAE at the moment, you have to pay 9% of your salary on anything you earn over between 7.6 and 8.3 thousand dirhams a month. Ooh. So actually, you know, it's quite low.
Interesting. Because when I graduated, I was earning so little, I was paying about £11 a week, a month back. And it was, yeah, I think that's why it took so long to kind of chip away at it. Can I come back to that original question, which is that idea of return on investment? If we're looking at £60,000, what questions would you be asking, obviously as a financial expert, but also as a dad, in terms of, is this a good use of A, your time, but B, money? What's your take, Stephen?
I mean, my own personal experience, obviously this was in 1820. What happened with me is that there were no tuition fees. I probably got more of a, like you, I got more of a social education, mm-hmm, than a an academic education, although there was a bit of that. But it also got me a really good job coming out of university. Mm-hmm. So it did make a difference for me. I think the people who don't benefit from university are the entrepreneurial types.
Yeah, and it feels like you're kind of having 3 or 4 years of delaying the inevitable, which you might not even, you know, you just might as well just crack on, really.
Yeah, or the really like non-academic, yeah, types. And there you might as well go for some kind of vocational qualification or just start work.
Steve Cronin's with us today. When we come back, we're going to be addressing Ben's question, which says, I've heard that some student debts are written off after 25 years. So what's the incentive to actually pay them? Is that true? should I just hung tight? And Franklin, I don't know if Steve can help you, but let's find out. Franklin's saying, I left the UK in 2005 and I can't even remember if I had a student loan from university. I know if I did, I haven't paid it back. How do I find out about this stuff? I don't know. Steve Cronin's got a couple of minutes to do some research, though. Talking about the decision to go to university on the financial front, really staggering amount of student loan debt in the US, $1.6 trillion as of Q4 2023. And a message here saying, hi there, a doctor from the US, I owe 400,000 out of that 1.6 at 6.7%. I'm paying $1,500 per month to Uncle Sam at 43. I don't see it paying off until I'm on Social Security. In my opinion, undergrad loans are not worth it. Speaking to a student now, this is Sabah.
Personally, I didn't take out a student loan. Despite being a British citizen, I was classified as an international student because I was primarily residing in Dubai at the time. This meant I had to pay international fees upfront, which was quite financially burdensome. For my postgraduate studies, I was fortunate to receive a scholarship from my law firm, which covered the cost of my postgraduate legal exams and master's degree. Many of my classmates, however, did take out student loans and are facing significant debt. One friend, who studied a lengthy medical course, has accumulated over £100,000 in debt. Another friend, who pursued multiple degrees, now owes upward of £80,000. I often chat with my classmates about how this debt impacts their lives. You know, it's disheartening to hear these stories. The idea of starting a career with such a heavy financial burden can be overwhelming. Some of my friends even wonder if it was worth pursuing higher education, given the stress and financial pressure they now face. I think these experiences underscore the need for us to think about how we can make higher education more accessible and affordable. It is important to support graduates and ensure that student loans don't become an insurmountable obstacle to their success and well-being.
Saba Vaziri there talking about her experience. Steve Cronin of Dead Simple Saving. A number of questions for you, sir. One here from David saying, are there any student financing options available in the UAE that don't involve your parents having to take a personal loan from the bank? In other words, loans that can be issued in the student's name. Do you know of any financial products or services that could fit the bill for David and the family?
That's an interesting one because loans in the UAE, personal loans are based on your salary. And if you're a student, then you don't have a salary. So it's going to be very, very risky. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's going to be a particularly good option. And I actually don't know of any banks that do that. But never say never. I mean, you can ask them. And maybe you could get a loan that's guaranteed by your parents. Mm-hmm. That is an option. But it could be tricky.
And Ben saying, I've heard that some student debts are written off after 25 years. So what's the incentive to actually pay them? Is that true? Because this was always the rumour. Like, oh, if you don't pay it for 10 years, they forget about it. It's like, it's not free money. Like, it's a loan. Otherwise, you're effectively stealing it. But 25 years, is that a threshold that you've heard before?
So it's complicated and it varies across each country. But if you took out your first student loan, i.e. your first year of university before 2006, then you have to wait till you're 65, by which time you've probably paid a huge amount of interest mm-hmm. and monthly payments, unless you're on a low salary. And we're talking about like literally kind of below 11,000 dirhams a month, mm-hmm. right? Lowish salary. So if you're earning more than that, it's probably worth paying it off beforehand, because if you took out a loan after 2006, then yes, it is written off after 25 years. After 2012, it's written off after 35 years. So again, there's a lot of complexity here. I think you need to look at your salary, you need to look at the size of your loan, you need to look at what your payments are each month, and the date for your particular loan category when it might get paid off. But doing some rough calculations, 25 years is a long time, and 35 years is a long time. Mm-hmm. And so you would probably, you know, if you went back to the UK, for example, and got a job, they would start taking it out through the PAYE system. So in general, it's pretty hard to avoid this debt unless you are a low earner. And I would be tempted, if you can afford to just
get it done,
pay it off, or just keep paying those monthly payments.
Yeah. Can I ask you a personal question, Steve? As a father, what are your plans for financial, for saving loans with, you know, the next generation in mind? What's happening in the Cronin household? And I know it's a way off.
I actually started saving for my children's education in 2002, which was 18 years before I had my first child, which is a bit odd. But I had a pot of money and I've just allocated that to my kids' education.
I'm such a bad parent. Oh, God.
And it's still not big enough. You know, like, that's astonishing, right? Is that education so expensive now? It really depends on whether it's university is worth it for your child. I'd be very careful about them loading up with master's degrees and PhDs and specialities if they don't need it straight after university.
I was just about to say, by all means, you know, crack on and do that on your own dollar, you know, 10 years down the line. But otherwise, you could be looking at seven years of no earning and just learning and having a big debt at the end of it. And last question, there's from Franklin saying, I left the UK in 2005 and can't even remember if I have a student loan. I know if I did, I haven't paid it back. Can you find out this stuff?
Yes, so gov.uk has a really good, you can just Google it, lots of information about this. Also, savethestudent.org is a great website for this sort of thing. But there is an arrears inquiries hotline. That sounds fun, doesn't it?
Great.
Where you can phone them and you can say, I don't know what's happened, help me.
Do you know what happened to me? I moved here. They sent a letter to my parents' address. My dad dobbed me in. He was like, she can be found at this address. This is my dad, does everything by the law and the letter. I'm like, cheers, Dave. Hoping that moving countries might have got me away with that. Steve, thank you for your time. Really, really appreciate it. Now, you don't just talk about education. You are an incredible resource for all aspects of financial education and coaching. Have you got any workshops coming up? Any resources that we can point people in the direction of?
My website, deadsimplesaving.com. That's the best place. And I'm giving people a break over the summer. So all my workshops restart in September. But meanwhile, lots of free information on my website, deadsimplesaving.com.
You're a star. Steve Cronin, thank you so, so much. I feel a little bit nauseous about to say the numbers here. Total amount of outstanding student loan debt in the US at the end of last year was $1.6 trillion. Soaring college costs, pressure to compete in the job market, massive factors for student loan debt. And we are going to be speaking to independent financial coach of Dead Simple Saving, Steve Cronin, after 5:30 to talk about the money side of matters, you know, whether it's borrowing or indeed saving for higher education. But now joining us is Sarai Beheshti, the Managing Director at Crimson Education, to talk about some of the options that you have as expats, about choices about where to go in the world, you know, the questions you should be asking yourself and indeed your bank balance. And I've already had messages asking about home status as well, if you are an expat looking to go to the UK as a UK passport holder. Sarai, how are you?
Hi, very well, thanks. It's a pleasure to chat with you again. I always enjoy these.
Me too. Now, we've spoken before when we were talking about university rankings and just how daunting it is to choose the quote unquote right university. But then you throw in student loans and debts. So what are some of the key factors to your mind? What should students and their families evaluate when selecting a university based potentially on student loan debt?
Really interesting, because I went to Columbia, which is probably, I think at the time, was the most expensive university in the US. But I actually, it was the cheapest option for me, because Columbia offered me, you know, it's not just loans. There's many different financing options available. There's merit-based scholarships. There's financial aid, which is a specifically unique U.S. Feature of their system. So Columbia had given me a variety of that of those kinds of support. And so it is really nuanced, right? You can't just look at the tuition fee, because even within the financial aid system, universities are more or less generous or have different kinds of policies. Around 60% of students on the Ivy League are on financial aid, and that can vary between 100% coverage of their tuition fees and, you know, accommodation, and it could be just partial coverage too. So something that I find it really helpful for families to think about is the cost to value ratio. So, you know, investing $35,000 to go to a university that doesn't have great employment prospects and that doesn't really have a lot of great resources is maybe not worth it. You might be worth going to sort of a local university that's cheaper. Mm-hmm. However, investing $40,000, if that's available to your family, but you're going to one of the best institutions in the world, that is going to be more valuable to you and going to have a faster payoff, because those universities tend to have higher graduate starting salaries and so on. So you do want to spend a lot of time really thinking strategically about all your options. International students can't get access to federal aid or loans in the US, but there are financial aid or merit scholarships which are very much available to them.
Whereas I went to uni in the UK, and I think I only paid off my student loan about 7 years ago. because because when I graduated, I was earning so little. They were taking like £11 out of my salary to start to pay back a loan of about 30,000. And then obviously it becomes kind of commensurate to what you're earning. And I was expecting, I was expecting like a celebration when I find, you know, like a bunch of flowers from the student loan company or even just a letter of congratulations. And it was like, nope, it's just kind of, it's just done. It's just done now. It's not just a choice. Which I was glad. I'm glad it's done. I've had quite a few questions for you, Sarai. So we are going to go to the text line in just a minute. Before we get to that, though, I wanted to ask, kind of bring up the point which you alluded to earlier, was it's not just the tuition costs. You know, living expenses, you know, where you choose the city, the rent, things like that. Mm-hmm. Is there a formula? Do you guys at Crimson have, you know, a spreadsheet or, you know, any kind of like tools that can really help people drill down some of these costs?
Yeah, so we do. And we actually formally help students with their scholarship and financial aid applications because they're different. And we provide these kind of resources to our students. But if someone wanted to create one, what I would do is just create a spreadsheet. Every university in the US and the UK and Europe is going to list its tuition fees. They may have an approximation for living expenses. They may not. You might have to figure that out on your own. And often in the US, they will have financial aid calculators too. So it's quite a robust system. It's not just so much like, oh, what is your parents' income? Mm-hmm. They will look at things like, are there other dependents? Like their grandparents or other siblings that are going to be relying on your that are going to be relying on your parents as well. They're going to look at other debts that the family has, and they're going to create what I think is like actually a pretty fair system and an expected tuition amount for you. So you can find that on the university, and then you could plug all of these details into your spreadsheet and really compare it. It's going to take some time, but it's definitely worth it. The other thing that you want to look at is whether a university is need blind or need aware. There are only literally a handful of schools which are need blind, which means they look at your application without knowing whether or not you're going to apply for aid. So these would be like, you know, your Harvard, for example, is one. And then every other school is need aware, which means they are going to take it into consideration. So the best thing that you can do to really prepare to get a nice financial aid or scholarship package is just to be to submit the best application that you can and really be someone that they don't want to turn away, because they will pay for you if they want you.
Well, that's what I want to dive into next. So coming up, we're going to be talking about advice for international students, particularly expats, to maximise their chances of securing scholarships or financial aid. Are there any particular universities or courses, areas or industries where you have good chances? We've also had a message from Bev. Bev's asking about the process of applying for a home fee status for a UK university. They've got property in the UK, but has heard that if you own property in the UAE, it can count against you. Is that the case? A bit of a hot topic right now. As we said, student loan globally is unbelievably high, US and UK. And really interesting to talk to people from other parts of the world as well. Milani saying that was, you know, loans not available in the Philippines, you know, here in the UAE, people saving money for universities too. So talking there about the financial aid packages that can be available at some schools. And I wanted to ask you, how can international students, especially expats, maximise their chances of securing scholarships, getting financial aid to minimise their reliance on either student loans or personal loans that they or their families might be taking on? Are there any schools, courses, areas where you might have a better chance?
Well, I would say that the US financial aid system is easily and by far the most generous in the world. And it's very different to scholarships. You might have a UK university where a scholarship is restricted to, you know, a few students a year or 10% of the class. Whereas we're talking, like I said, 60% at some of the top private universities in the US. And financial aid is usually a combination. It's usually need based. But some universities, specifically in the Ivy League, will have a merit-based component as well. And they do sort of a really thorough analysis of your financial situation and then determine what's fair for you to contribute. So I would say if financial aid is important, definitely look at the US because it can be really, really a lot cheaper. And then absent of any aid or scholarship, European public universities are also incredibly affordable. And interestingly, Chinese as well. Chinese universities are really, really affordable and some of the best in the world. And some of them do have English taught programs. So I think that actually would make a candidate very strong graduating from a Chinese university. So it's something to consider. The UK is probably the toughest area to get, scholarship. It's just so, it's restricted so much. Mm-hmm. But in addition to the institutional scholarships, you can also look at private scholarships. There are many databases online where you can search by country, by major, and these might be based on things like ethnicity, special interests, so, you know, women in STEM or Turkish students or something like that. There are plenty of those online as well. There are also resources like Leap Finance. I highly recommend. Like, they're a global company that have a lot of resources related to, you know, education financing.
Which brings me on to Bev's question, who says, I have a question regarding the process of applying for home fees status for UK universities. I know it helps to own a property in the UK, but I wondered if it makes any difference owning a property in the UAE. I've read that it can be a negative, but wondered in reality if that has been the case. We're currently considering buying, but want to understand if it would have an impact on this first. Thank you. Can you explain what home status fees are when it comes to UK universities? And then we can unpack Bev's question perhaps a little bit more, Soraya.
Sure. So universities in the UK have a limit on what the tuition fees can be for what they call UK domiciled students. So to get access to home status, which is a lot cheaper than international fees, you do have to prove that you're ordinarily resident in the UK. And students must have been resident in the UK for the 3 years before they start university. The policies do change, so it's worth just keeping an eye on that if you're a couple of years away. And they are very strict on this, because this is important revenue for the university. So they will look at not just properties, but they will look at employment of the parents. They're going to look at visa status to basically prove that you haven't been faking living in the UK. Mm-hmm. But there are also options for students to, like, be billeted with families in the UK or with a relative, or possibly go to boarding school if they're a UK citizen and can become resident there as well. So you might want to think, but definitely plan in advance.
And also get good advice. Thank you for your advice. Really, really do appreciate it. It's amazing to think about the options that are out there that perhaps are just not plugged into. So for anyone that does want your details, you obviously work with people all over the world and all the way through the academic calendar as well.
And I've been there before. I myself used Crimson Education to get my scholarship. So I know exactly everything you're feeling if you're a parent or a student that's worried about this.
Thank you. Really, really appreciate it. Soraya Bashti speaking to us from Crimson Education. Sounds like a very complicated, it really, really does. There's so many options out there, but also so many opportunities. Oh, the summer is upon us. I've already had a phone call from my kids saying, Mum, can we go on the iPads this afternoon? It's the holidays. So we are helping you out now as we talk routine. Schedule, how are they different? Sleep, jet lag, activities, maybe a bit of relationship counselling. I've already had a question about in-laws today. Leilani Rooks is with us today, family coach from Wildflower Collective. And you're speaking to us from the US, I think, Leilani.
Yeah, that's right. I'm here in Virginia.
So would you mind, for anyone that hasn't tuned into us before, giving a bit of a recap on your setup in terms of age of your kids, but more importantly, for those listening today, how we can help? What are we going to be getting from this next hour, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am very much in the thick of routines and routine disruption as well. I have a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old that I am settling into the summer very much. So our family is very much going through all of this routine disruption as well right now. And I try and use my expertise as best as I can with my family, but for others as well. I work with individuals, with couples, with parents, with whole families to bring more peace to your home, to make family time enjoyable and not just chaotic and stressful all the time. And we very much know that summer can be tons of fun and also tons of stress and a bit of chaos for the family. So that's what I'm here to help you all with today, to hopefully bring some more of that joy and peace and a little bit less of that just summer stress.
4001 if you've got any questions for late Lani. Now tell us, 3 and 5 on the plane to the States, how was that?
You know what? They're at a nice age where they will sit and watch TV the whole time.
Yeah, same.
And it's, I am, you know, I think it's survival on the plane, isn't it? It's you throw the rules and the routine out the window. You do what you need to do for everyone to be okay, for you not to completely disrupt other people's plane experience. But unfortunately, on our way here, the screens were out. They were not working. And so
you had to do like a of course full it was 1990s plane journey experience.
Yeah, they were like, I don't understand what you mean that this isn't going to function for us. Oh, no. We were lucky it worked for about an hour and a half. But, you know, in an 8-9 hour journey, we were coming from we had a layover somewhere else first. So it wasn't the full kind of 13 hours. But and we had an iPad, one iPad. But, you know, with two children, one thing between the two of them is sometimes more stress than help. So it was interesting, you know, but we got through it. And
thank you for saying that you use iPads. I just feel like sometimes when we're talking about kind of families and, you know, expectations, this idea of being completely screen free is completely unrealistic. So thank you for speaking to myself. What about jet lag? Any advice on jet lag, whether that is from experts that you've spoken to around sleep, obviously your own experiences? What's what any help us?
You know, I think that when it comes to routine disruption, jet lag, sleep, plane ride, the more that we can just surrender to that this is a limited period of time, and we know it will be with the plane, right? We have to get off the plane eventually. We know it will be with the jet lag. It'll last hopefully no more than a couple of days, but even if it's a little longer than that, we know that there's an end point to it. So the more that we can just surrender and kind of imagine in our head that we will get to that end point, the better, because when we're really just struggling with it and unwilling to just take it for what it is, that's kind of when it becomes the most unbearable, when we are worrying about the worry,
which kids pick up on as well, you know, if we're feeling stressed. Leilani Rooks is with us today, family coach from Wildflower Collective. She's speaking to us from the States, so she is living the disruption and chaos that is upon many of us. Up next, I want to get Leilani's take on the difference between a schedule and a routine and why understanding this distinction is really important for families, especially if you are somewhere else over the summer. We've also had some questions about refusing to go to camp. So I think camps are being used quite a lot by families over the summer, especially if you've got two working parents. Catherine's saying our kids are 11 and 9. They need to go to camp for a few weeks. It's all paid for, but they are refusing to go, saying they hate it. I am shattered and out of ideas for convincing them and would welcome yours. Catherine, I'm going to give Leilani a couple of minutes to think about that, and I will welcome you all back on the other side of this. The summer is stretching ahead of us, so we're bringing in the experts to hold our hand. Leilani Rooks is with us today. She's a family coach from Wildflower Collective. Leilani, let's get into it. Can you explain the difference between a schedule and a routine and why understanding that difference, that distinction, is really important for families in general, but also especially at this time of year where both concepts might be somewhat shaken up?
Yeah, absolutely. So the difference between a schedule and routine, although they are sometimes used kind of interchangeably, is a schedule is much more strict. So it's more time oriented, it's less flexible, and it's tends to be more planned, right? So this is like what we have most of the time during the school year. We have to be at school at this time. We have lunch at this time. Pickup is this time. Whatever practice is at this time. Bedtime is at this time. And there's not much flexibility there, right? We have to go from one place to the next. We have to do these things in this order at this time. Whereas a routine is much more of kind of just habit. It's a regular habitual procedure, more like. So it's like we do things in a certain order. The timing might be slightly different. The amount of time we spend doing it might be slightly different. But it's just kind of a general framework for how things go throughout a day. So doing things in a certain order.
Okay.
So we wake up, we brush our teeth, we go to the bathroom, we get dressed. But that could be at, 8 a.m. like it was for my kids yesterday, or it could be like at 6 a.m. like it is today. So it is going to vary more, especially in these times of transition. But there's a general routine of this is how things go, even if it's slightly different in what that looks like.
So here's my question then, Lani. When children experience disruption to their schedules and or routines, what are some of the common behavioral, emotional, physical signs that parents need to look out for? And what can it kind of lead to if there's been a disruption that maybe hasn't been communicated or dealt with effectively?
Yeah, and I think that one thing I want to point out is that even when we do deal with it really well, effectively, you're likely to see some of the behavioral, emotional, even physical kind of consequences of routine and disruption. And we'll see that with ourselves as well, right? So we might experience physical symptoms, headaches, stomach aches, sleep disruption, right? Being really sleepy, but being unable to sleep or sleeping too often, emotional disruption or behavioral, more tantrums, more clinginess, more just big feelings in general, more complaining, you know, just a little bit more heightened experience of pretty much everything you can expect.
The same for same for us as well. When we have that idea of uncertainty,
we've seen it
in, numerous times. Obviously, the last few years, the pandemic being one. When we haven't got our anchors, when we haven't got the answers, everything feels heightened and when little people have the bigger feelings, and we're supposed to be the anchors and the answers, and maybe we're feeling disrupted and unsure and exhausted and irritable, it can be really, really difficult. It's a really interesting question that's come in for you here from Angel, saying, I am a routine parent through and through. Nap times, bedtimes, meal times, it can be restrictive, but I find it works for us. On the flip side, I have friends who are absolutely no routine parents, out for late dinner with toddlers, two-year-olds up past 11 p.m., no morning routine unless at school. I find it so interesting. Spending even a weekend or holiday like this has had me floored, although I'm sure the non-routine parents find me absolutely boring. My question is, how do non-routine kids adapt to formal settings like nursery and school? I know kids are adaptable, so perhaps they take it to a fish like water, but I'm just curious. That's a really interesting question. What do you think in terms of adaptability? And it's not to say one is right and one is wrong as such, although I have to say I can't bear to see kids at the mall past 10 p.m. or it drives me absolutely insane. But when it comes to getting back into a routine at school, what do you think can work and not work? What do parents need to be tuned into there? Angel's saying she's obviously a routine parent, but what's your take?
Yeah, I think that the biggest thing is paying attention to what's working for your family. So there are going to be some families where that absolutely does work to kind of have a routine, but again, not have that schedule where they're kind of switching it up what they're doing. So maybe their routine is in the afternoons we go out, but they decide what they're doing to go out at the very last minute, and then they stay out all afternoon. Whereas there are going to be some parents and families that need to know, have it put in the calendar or have options to do weeks in advance for their afternoon activity. But I think that you really need to pay attention to what works best for you. So this person writing in, clearly for her sanity, for her family, for her child, that works best to have a routine. For other families, that doesn't work. There needs to be, maybe based on the child's temperament, maybe based on needing to meet multiple children's needs. There's a lot of factors.
And parental needs as well. I hear this from friends saying, we do keep the kids up probably later than we should because, me or my husband doesn't get home, don't get home from work until 8 or 9 o'clock, and we want to see the kids in the evening. There sometimes needs to be a bit of ebb and flow and back and forth. And I guess maybe we'll have a conversation in a few months about getting kids back into a routine after a summer of, complete disruption. Leilani's with us today. If you've got any questions for her, please don't hesitate to get in touch. We are talking about this all the way through. As I said, we've had a question from Catherine about refusing to go to camp. Also had a message. And I know you do a lot of couples counselling as well, marriage work. So a message here that I think is really in your wheelhouse that we're going to come to before 3 o'clock as well, saying, I'm going to meet my partner's children from his first marriage over the summer. They're 7 and 4, and I don't know how to play this. Not comfortable around children at all. Don't want to be too familiar, but I'm being introduced as his girlfriend, and I'm hoping to be around for a while. Really interesting one. So we'll get Leilani's take on that too. From sleeping in an unfamiliar space to sibling fights, jet lag and more, the summer can be a bit fraught for families, to be honest. And then you often throw in the kind of financials as well. So it's understandable why we have quite mixed feelings about, yay, school's finishing, but oh, now it's a whole new set of challenges. Well, joining us live on Teams from the US is Leilani Rooks. She is a family coach from Wildflower Collective. She's also a mum of two. And she works with families, couples and individuals, as she so beautifully puts it, to bring some fun and enjoyment and reduce the noise and the chaos, the stress of family life. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that unfamiliar, about communication with our kids, about, you know, we're going to be here, we're going to be there, this is what it's going to look like. Because, you know, we do often say in quite a throwaway way, you know, our kids are so resilient, but it can be very disruptive, especially, you know, if you've got a neurodiverse child who has these, you know, touch points that they really, really do need. How important is it to explain what the plans are? Are there any kind of strategies, visuals that can be really helpful for helping them understand exactly what's going to be happening over the coming weeks and months?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it comes down to knowing your kid again and knowing what's best for your family. But there is certainly a balance between preparing them and sharing with them what's going to happen, where you're going and when, but also doing it too far in advance. Mm-hmm. I think that if we do it too far in advance, especially for younger children who don't quite understand the concept of time and days and sleeps and all of that, if we're preparing them too far in advance, it really gives a lot of time for anxiety and worry and just excitement as well to build up in maybe not such a helpful way. So finding the balance. Yeah.
How many sleeps until we see Granny? You're like, 50.
Right. Exactly. So finding that right timeline between preparing them for sure, not telling them, you know, an hour before you're about to get on the plane, mm-hmm. but also not giving it enough time for too much to be swirling through their head. And as far as tools to help with that, I think it absolutely makes sense to start discussing where you're going and maybe even doing things like showing pictures from previous visits, especially for younger kids who the idea of, especially as an expat family, you know, the idea of family or grandma or cousins or whoever that they haven't seen in a whole entire year, perhaps, they understand, but at the same time, the memory is a bit fuzzy or they're just not quite sure what to expect or who to expect. Showing pictures of where you'll go, bringing up memories from the last summer or showing pictures of the last summer, just kind of jogging the memory a bit, getting them excited so that they have more of a mental picture of who and what to expect once you get there. And it's not all just kind of abstract, brand new input for them.
I think that also raises a really interesting point, Leilani, about this idea of familiarization with family. Because we've had this before where the grandparents have been like, oh my goodness, the girls are here. We're so excited. And it's like a flurry of hugs and affection and, you know, physical touch. And sometimes you can see kids just like frozen in the headlights going, this feels like almost like a stranger to me because I'm only five and I haven't seen you for a year, which is kind of confusing. And I think can cause a bit of hurt and upset and rejection from family members. And they're going, where's the kiss for Granny? How do you think we can talk to our kids about what expectations they might have and how to maybe talk? I mean, a consent's a very big loaded word, but I hope you understand where I'm kind of going with that.
Yeah, I think part of it is talking with your kids and helping them understand, you know, our family is really excited to see us. They haven't seen us in a long time. Let me know if you feel uncomfortable, or maybe we could have a signal or like a hand squeeze or some kind of tool we can use as a family if you need a little break or a pause or you're feeling uncomfortable. And at the same time, maybe even more important is, and something I have to do every single year, is trying to help manage the expectations of the adult family members that we're going to see. Reminding them that we've just traveled thousands of miles, we're jet lagged, they're in a new place, we're living out of suitcases for weeks and switching all around. And I think it's really hard for family members, especially who haven't had kind of this expat experience, mm-hmm. to fully conceptualize what that means for children and what that means for their relationship as well. So the more that you can manage the expectations of the adult family members you're going to see as well, and reassuring them, it doesn't mean that they don't love you. It doesn't mean they're not excited to see you. It might simply mean that
it's an adjustment,
they're in a new place again.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Makes sense.
You know, so just that clear communication all around, managing expectations for everyone, I think.
Which brings me on to a message here. It's anonymous, saying, any advice for dealing with grandparents? My in-laws have zero interest in following our routines or rules around food or screens. And for a week, that would be fine. But this year, we're going to be together for nearly a month. I mean, this is a show in itself. It really is. But, and I know you obviously can't speak to the specific family because we don't know any more than that. But any general rules and guidelines? Because it can be a real pain point of this. Well, you're in our house, but this is how I parent, you know, and it can be quite confusing. Yeah. I find when I go to my mum and dad's, so I'm like, I'm your daughter, but I'm also the mother of these children. And it's quite an interesting power dynamic. She said,
yeah,
diplomatically.
For sure. Yeah, that's right. That's well said, for sure. I think that having the conversation with your family, whether that means with your parents beforehand or with your partner, going into it with as clear of expectations and intentions as possible. So that might mean that you let go of some of your schedule, some of your things that are important to you at home, that you're a bit more flexible when it comes to screen time or sweets or whatever, but making sure that you're clear for yourself and your family if there are any specific points that you really want to stick to. Mm-hmm. So what does it look like for us to be a little bit more flexible with sweets? What does it look like for us to be a little bit more flexible with these things? Because understanding as well that, or thinking ahead to when we're grandparents, I certainly want to spoil my grandchildren and not have to worry about discipline and rules as much, right? That's the fun of being a grandparent. But so trying to meet those needs on their side, but also deciding where you want to stand really firm and kind of letting the rest be a bit more loose, a bit more flexible, because in that way you can really stand your ground with your parents on those few points and give more free rein for the rest of it. But I think also when it comes to such a long period of time, that's when routines are going to be even more important, right? You can be off routine for a week and more or less you'll survive, but for an entire month, going into it with more intentionality about what you want it to look like and having that conversation, preferably without the kids around, with your parents, so that everyone's needs are kind of being met in that scenario.
And it doesn't need to be a kind of last time you did this and it didn't work. You know, it can kind of be,
absolutely,
this is what we're trying to work on with, you know, so and so, and this is what's worked before.
Yeah.
So it'd be great to have you on board, you know, the framing.
Yeah.
You know.
Also with that, one thing I want to say with that also is if there are specific reasons that, for example, you don't want your child on screen time for, you know, watching a movie for 3 hours straight, pointing that out to the grandparents if that does happen and your reasoning for that. So, for example, we have this debate in my parents' house where I'm at right now often with the TV, right? And they'll watch a lot of TV when we go out, and I'm like, okay, I'm grateful for the free babysitting, but also my children lose it when we get home, right? Mm-hmm. Because they've watched too much. And so I'm able to tell my parents, hey, all this screaming you're hearing now for 30 minutes, we notice this happens after a lot of screen time. And it's not nice for us to listen to as adults. It's not nice for the kids. It's a bit too much for their bodies and minds. They're overwhelmed with the screen time. This is why we manage screen time. Kind of, this is the consequences of not following what we found is best for our family.
You're experiencing,
and they can see that
the root of this. Okay, love that.
Yeah, and they might be a little bit more likely to be on board when they realize that the manic behavior afterwards is a consequence of all the screen time or sweets.
Thank you, Leilani. I'm going to send this to my parents. We've got Leilani with us through until 3 o'clock. Today's another 15 minutes if you've got any questions. As I said, we are going to come to a couple of messages I just highlighted before about meeting a partner's children and also camp refusal. Catherine's got two kids who need to go to camp for a couple of weeks because of practical working reasons, but they really don't want to go. She is out of ideas, so we're turning to our expert. Joining us from Wildflower Family Coaching, Leilani is with us today. She works with individuals, couples, parents and families. And as she so beautifully put it on Instagram, you know, feel respective, feel effective, feel connected. And we're addressing some of the pain points that so many people struggle with over the summer, which is disrupted routine, family dynamics as well. And, you know, financials have come up a couple of times, actually, Lani. We've had a message asking about screen time tips when they're at home all day. Can't afford camps this year. I think you mentioned before some really good advice. But asking here, should kids earn iPad time? Funny enough, I saw a video, I think it was last night, of, and it had gone viral because it was revolting, of a girl on a little girl, must be about six, on a treadmill saying, here she is earning her screen time. I'm like, wow, what a wonderful way to make her completely resent exercise and fetishize screen time. How do you feel about earning screen time? Or I guess, I don't know. I find it's a bit like kind of labeling food good and bad. I find it quite complicated and a bit, you know, emotive, really. What's your take?
Yeah, you know, I might avoid the term earning, but I think that the idea of we do other things or we make room for other activities and other things that are important to us so that we have and we keep some space for screen time could be really useful. Mm-hmm. So similar to a diet, like you're saying, you know, if we're filling our diet with protein, healthy proteins and greens and fruits, then we're not going to have as much space for those sweets. Anyways, right? And I think it's very much the same with screen time, where it's if we can say, okay, we'll save some space for screen time, but we want to fit in all of these other things first. We want to fit in
variety,
outside time if
exactly.
possible. All of these other things we want to fill our space with first, mm-hmm. then we might, you could say earn, but we might have space for screen time once we've done all these other fulfilling things first.
Good analogy. Right, message here from Catherine that I touched on earlier saying we need our kids, 11 and 9, to go to camp for a few weeks over summer because of work commitments. The problem is they're refusing to go. They say they hate camp. They're due to start on Monday. It's all paid for. I'm shattered. I'm out of ideas for convincing them. Would welcome yours. That's hard.
Yeah. So of course, as a parent, my initial reaction would be like, you know, too bad. There's no choice. You have to go. We have to work.
That was mine as well.
But I think that taking a step back, having a conversation with the kids, just to understand more, be curious about, you know, what's making you not look forward to camp? What is it about going to camp or this specific camp that you're not looking forward to? And what were you hoping for with your summer? And the point of this conversation would not be that you can fix it or change it at this point, right? It's just gathering information, but more so it's just giving your kids a helpful space to get off their chest whatever is bothering them.
Yeah, and for them to understand that you're on the same team ultimately. It's not, you know, us versus you. It's like, this is us
exactly.
as a family. This is what the situation looks like. So this is your role in the family.
Exactly. And with that as well, I would be curious about, you know, if I had to wonder, I would wonder if perhaps they're, and for a lot of kids as well, when we're talking about routine and schedule, they go to school, they work really hard all year long. They're done. They've made it. They want to rest a bit, right? They want a break from the schedules. Mm. And unfortunately, camp doesn't necessarily allow for a break in that less flexibility planned schedule. It's still something they have to be kind of on for. They have to be going for. They have to be alert and kind of, yeah, they have to be on for, right? Mm-hmm. And so with that, knowing that camp is not an option, they have to go to camp, you all are working, and unfortunately, that's non-negotiable, how can we make more flexibility, more downtime, give some space for boredom, really, for some chill time for your kids outside of the camp routine. So maybe that means keeping weekends less busy or scheduled, or keeping evenings less busy and scheduled, giving them the space to have that summer boredom that really is what we all need a bit, even if it feels a little uncomfortable or unusual at first, giving them the space to kind of counter that busy schedule camp time.
Catherine, if it helps, my kids are going to camp next week. They don't especially want to go, but I'm working. My husband's working on our nannies away, so they are going boxing for the week. We've run out of time. To the messages we weren't able to address, I'm going to send over your Instagram so people can reach out to you direct. And I know your Instagram's a fantastic resource for everyone in general. So people want to send me the word family, I will reply with Leilani from Wildflower Family Coaching's Instagram. Some brilliant advice, kind of evergreen insights. But as I said, you can talk to her about some one-on-one stuff if you do need a bit of extra support. Wishing you and yours a wonderful summer, Leilani. Thank you so, so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it. Have you spotted some work going on around where you live. It might be because His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, Vice President of the UAE and ruler of Dubai, has approved an initiative to improve water drainage in the Emirate. It's called the Tashreef Project and it's going to cost 30 billion dirhams, scheduled for completion by the end of 2033. We're talking flood prevention, sustainability, waving a magic wand over this emirate. Joining us now, Dr. Stephen Wilkinson, Associate Professor at the University of Wollongong, just nearby here in Dubai. He's also the head of the Smart and Sustainable Cities Research Cluster. He's got a PhD from Imperial College in London and is an expert in sustainability and environmental awareness with, as we're talking about today, extensive research and practical experience on flood management, contaminated land and urban resilience too. Dr. Stephen, how are you, sir?
Good. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. I think it's, and I've got to say, it's kind of selfish because there is a lot of work going on around where I live. And it looks to me, I'm no expert, it looks to me like it might be storm drain related. But I wanted to ask you this. Can you explain the significance of this project, 30 billion dirhams, so something the UAE government's obviously taking very, very seriously. To your best of your knowledge, how is it aiming to future-proof the city against floods in particular?
Well, it's a huge improvement on the current network. The older network within the business district city had 47 pumping stations, small stations, and in the last decade, there was this Dubai deep tunnel stormwater system, which was completed in 2001, and that drained Expo and Dubai South area.
Right, that end.
And it worked reasonably well during the recent storms. But this this new project, this is looking at expanding the capacity of that and expanding the areas where it will be applied to. So it's looking at redeveloping the 47 pumping stations in the older side of the city to have a much larger capacity within that area.
Can I ask you, did you find it quite interesting to observe the recent floods with your kind of expert hat on? I'm sure your insights were very different to our kind of lived experience. Looking back, what were your big takeaways from those few days?
Yeah, it's different to the flooding that I've experienced elsewhere in the world, because you normally think of, oh, there's a river and the river's going to burst its banks, but there is no river. The rain is coming down and the water's coming up through the ground because the land is so low-lying. We've got groundwater just about where sea level is, slightly higher than sea level, so there's not much space underground for the water to seep into. So with all the rain that came down, we're getting this a rise up from the ground. It's completely different to what I've seen elsewhere.
So yeah, intellectually very, very interesting. And then it's been obviously been very taken very seriously in terms of the government tuning into some of these conversations and experts such as yourself to think about, well, gosh, you know, who knows what the future holds in terms of climate change. It was a once in 75 year storm, but that's not to say it couldn't happen again. So tell us a little bit about, you know, what are some of the most pressing challenges to your mind that Dubai faces in terms of climate change and flooding, Doctor?
The climate change side, at the moment we are seeing Hurricane Beryl, which was a Category 5 hurricane, which is rare anyway. And then we're seeing it, that's only occurred twice during July. And this is the earliest of those and the strongest of those storms. So around the world, we're starting to see much larger storms than would be expected. And the UAE in Dubai has a particular issue with climate change in that we get big storms, but we get them rarely. So when we're looking at planning, we can't say, well, this year and the next year, we're starting to see this gradual increase in rainfall, because we don't see a gradual increase one year to the next.
So far more
we see sporadic.
And that must
and
be very
storms.
Interesting from a developer point of view in terms of, you know, what do we choose to invest in? You know, what is worth our money in terms of seeing the benefit of that investment? Because it could be another 75 years. This building might not be around. And that's what I want to put to you next. Dr. Stephen Wilkinson is with us today from the University of Wollongong. I want to know if he could have a chat with all developers here in the UAE, what would be put in place with future flood prevention at the front of mind, but also us as individuals, anything we could be doing as well, community involvement. Joining us from the University of Wollongong, Dubai, is the Director of Research, Sustainability Expert, Dr. Stephen Wilkinson. We are talking about that Tash Reef project, 30 billion dirhams being invested in to improve water drainage in the emirate, talking about flood prevention. And I'm curious, and I'm not just asking this because my husband's a property developer, but when it comes to innovations or indeed ideals, the gold standard, what would you love to see developers here in the emirate putting into place with climate change, but also flood prevention at top of mind?
Part of what I'd like to see is more of the integration between communities. So there are designs for individual communities, and then they need to connect to the larger network, which mm-hmm. is put in place by the city. But the design varies from one community to another. It's very variable.
What about things like hardscaping, planting, things like that?
I think, we call it sustainable urban drainage systems, and that's just having that capacity within the local environment that can store water. Some of that would be like with a roundabout, try not to have the mound of earth and the statue on top, try and make it a little bit of a indent and have some storage underneath.
Oh, gosh.
Even the central reservation between roads can be used to store water, and It's not really done. You see, putting down the plastic layer almost at ground surface, with then the gravel being put on top of that. But if it were just a little bit deeper, then you could start
That's
storing
really
water.
Interesting. Do you find yourself, when you're travelling, looking at the way that other cities and countries have strategies in place? Is there anyone that you think is doing a fantastic job on that?
Different countries with different environments
and different challenges.
Different challenges. So in the UK, the approach of using farmland as storage. So you lose all the crops and you pay the farmer for those crops, but you then don't flood the city.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the decision-making process. In other countries, they've got the huge storm water systems, which are built beside roads or underneath roads. There's one that I've seen where it's a tunnel system and they've got the roadway in it, so cars travel in two directions on it. And as the water level rises, one section of the tunnel floods, and then the second section of the tunnel floods, and you stop traffic with traffic lights. So the tunnel has a dual use. It's used
wow.
as a road and then as a water drainage and storage system.
Gosh,
so there's
that's
a lot
amazing.
Of innovations going on around the world.
So then how do you then think about smart technologies, sustainable practices? You know, what are you identifying, and ultimately what are you teaching the next generation there at the university to bring on the next round of engineers and sustainability experts? What are you really excited about?
We've got a project at the moment which is using AI for flood planning. So we are trying to identify areas that flooding is more likely, and then look at the sorts of systems that we could put in at the small scale, and not the scale of this major project, which is looking at the city as a whole, but in a specific area, where could the water be temporarily stored so it doesn't go onto the infrastructure?
We spoke to a rocket scientist who was talking about how space can predict future flooding, which was really, really fascinating. I think we all saw some amazing aerial shots of Dubai, and certainly from space, back then as well. What about us as individuals? You know, you're a family man, been in Dubai 5 years. What are some of the things that you do with sustainability front of mind, Doctor? And kind of, I guess, how we all play our part in the preservation of the planet, because it's very easy to go, I'm just one person, we're just one house. What would you like us all to be doing?
Very, very difficult to be able to be sustainable all the time. And I think that the world is moving towards more sustainability, which makes it easier.
Mm-hmm.
But at the moment, we are very careful with the products that we buy. We are careful to try and use secondhand where we can, and try to make sure that what we do causes as little harm as possible. I often ask questions on sustainability forums, like for this aspect of my life, shopping for something, what's the best thing that I could be using, like sun cream here?
Oh, that's
can
interesting.
Can I avoid the plastic bottles?
Can
there's,
you?
There's these sticks that you can use that are wrapped in cardboard.
Really?
Yeah.
But isn't it interesting, because that's looking at where the opportunities lie rather than thinking this is a problem, this is a barrier. Because, and this is often, let's be honest, this is where money is going to be made in the future, where it comes to, you know, climate migration, or it comes to, you know, all sorts of different energy sources. It's not a case of all doom and gloom. It's where are the opportunities?
Mm. And in Dubai, I think that the movement is so rapid. One of the main issues is with energy systems, and with the opening up of the solar power plant, the nuclear power plant, the rate of decarbonisation of the energy grid is faster than most places across the world. Mm-hmm. So well, the change when it happens here will be rapid.
Yeah, it's agile, it's financed. What kind of conversations do you think we'll be having in 5-10 years' time when it comes to flood prevention as part of it, but I guess the climate change in this region in particular? Get your crystal ball out, Dr. Stephen.
Well, I think that here, as the energy grids start moving towards carbon neutral, then there's less worry about how much energy is being used. Right now, it's a big worry, and you want to try and minimise your energy consumption.
Just very quickly, I've had a message here from B saying, is it worth private residences having solar panels themselves? So if you buy a property, let's say you're in Arabian Ranches and you've got a standalone villa, is there any point in having solar panels at this stage?
Right now it will help, because energy system is still quite carbon intensive, but The UAE has put a plan together to get to carbon neutrality. Once it is carbon neutral, then the only advantage that you have from the solar panel is that you are generating your own energy, so you don't have to pay for it separately.
Sounds pretty good to me. Yeah. Dr. Stephen Wilkinson, thank you so much for joining us. Really, really appreciate your time. Good to get an insider's take on this project. Tashreef project is going to be scheduled to be completed by 2033, the cost of $30 billion. Dirhams, looking at flood prevention and improved water drainage in the emirate. But just to come back, we can all play our part as well in all aspects of sustainability and living responsibly for the planet. Now, only a few centuries ago, immersion in cold water was used as a device of punishment and torture. But in recent years, particularly through the pandemic, ice baths and cold water therapies have been really popularised by wellness influencers, by athletes, as a way of reducing stress and inflammation, increasing energy, get better sleep, boost the immune system. But not without its controversy. Recently, a Sunday Times investigation uncovered 11 cases where families claimed their loved ones had died after performing Wim Hof breathing method or similar with cold water therapy. So we're getting to the bottom of it, talking about responsible cold plunging. Danny is with us today. Danny is the founder of Longevity Wellness Hub, which does offer this, amongst other therapies. Endurance athlete himself, worked in corporate for decades and turned towards his passion now of boosting his own health and wellness and fitness and endurance, but also that of others as well. Have you done an ice bath this morning, Danny?
Yes, ma'am. First of all, it's good to be here.
Good to have you.
That's my daily routine.
Okay, right. I'm really into hearing about how people start their day, because I've made a few kind of changes to mine recently. Not an ice bath. How do you start your day?
Well, I can assure you, if you stand on a nail board for multiple minutes, followed by an ice bath, there is nothing you can't manage on a day.
Nail board. See, I've got one that's like little discs, right?
Yes.
What's that called? I can't remember what it's called.
It's the saddle board, I think.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, the saddle board. They're all the same.
So,
but they're different. They're different intensities. Yes.
So you stand on nails every morning.
Yes.
Effectively.
Yes.
And then absolutely. Have a cold plunge.
And then have a cold plunge.
At home, or are you going at the space?
Both.
I'm just amazed that you're surrounding myself.
I'm surrounding myself with my own remedies.
And this is daily.
Yes, ma'am. First time I jumped in an ice bath was in the Arctic Sea. I was doing the North Pole Marathon and it changed my life for 7 seconds.
Wow. Okay. I said to you off air, I started doing ice baths about 3 years ago as part of training for Kilimanjaro, because we were worried about altitude. We wanted to make sure we were maximising oxygen at altitude, conscious breathing. And I have got no counter. I've got no idea if it helped or not. I feel like it did. I genuinely feel like it did. What I've become quite annoyed by, and which is why I think it's quite interesting to think about this Sunday Times investigation, is the irresponsible places that are, you know, going, oh, we've got an ice bath, you know, here's 50 dirhams, go and do your thing, rather than it being respected and managed and people effectively being coached through something that is putting a stress on the body, effectively. Can you explain a little bit, before we get into the good practices and the red flags, from a kind of physiological point of view, let's throw some science at it, what are some of the benefits and indeed risks associated with ice baths?
Yeah. And first off, I mean, you're doing a really good thing here by encouraging education on that, because every day we're there to supervise people and actually tell them what they should and should not be doing. Sometimes it's very good for you to know what not to do, mm-hmm. right? So let me start with the benefits. And actually, before we start with the benefits, you should always ask questions on whether, first of all, if you have any medical conditions, it's always good to know more. If you have, because what happens is when you are in an ice bath, sometimes your insulin shoots up. And so what happens is, and your heart rate shoots up. So what happens is, if you have any blood pressure problems that you don't know of, or that you know of, you have to talk about. If you have any heart-related problems, if you have any diabetes, you definitely should let people around you know. Because what's happening in an ice bath is you are entering into a mini-shock scenario. And this is what I call the mini shock that opens up a whole lot of goodness, because the body loves cold water, but the mind hates it. And so what happens is, first of all, you should definitely speak more about what you're facing in terms of medical issues. Mm-hmm. And then you should do everything in moderation. We have a lot of clients that come to us and say, oh, I want to dip in the coldest water you have. And we say, well, why do you want to do that, right? They say, okay, because I want to see if I can take it or not. And what we do is we slow condition people to reach their to reach their maximum threshold. Now, the benefits are a wide range of benefits. First of all, the top two KPIs that I look at in my body today, and what I really want to coach people on, are controlling inflammation and reducing inflammation in their body, and controlling stress hormone, which is cortisol. Mm-hmm. Everything converges towards these two points today. And in my job, across 6 or 7 protocols and technologies that we use today, it all converges towards controlling people's inflammations and reducing them, and reducing stress hormone. Why am I saying that? I'm saying that because today, if I can control your cortisol, which is your stress hormone, you are able to burn fat the way you should be.
Well, it's interesting, because when we think about cortisol, it's often that kind of tummy fat, isn't it? You know, that's that kind of the midsection that people can find really, really hard to shift, because it's often so linked to mental as well as physical health.
And if you think about it, today, when your stress hormone is at a heightened level, mm-hmm. cortisol promotes fat protection.
Yeah.
So you're going to hold on to your fat. When we actually control cortisol, this is where you'll be able to metabolically go back to your levels in terms of burning fat. And so what happens in an ice bath is your cortisol, or your stress hormone reduction or management, is at its highest level. So that is a huge KPI, let alone the inflammation management that an ice bath can do. Now, when you think about it as well, all of that blood flow that stays there for 15 minutes, if you're staying, when it resonates, all of the goodness happens. So that's why I always say the body loves cold water. It's just the mind that needs to be trained.
We've had a message from Leo here saying, how long should you stay in for? And I think that's a really interesting question, because you talk there about people wanting to go as cold as possible. I've been in situations where, and I'm not to make generalizations, it has been men who are... Yes. Oh, last time I did 12 minutes, I want to go for 15 minutes. Yeah. And I'm like, do you need to be in an ice bath for 15 minutes, surely?
Yeah.
When do you start to see the benefits, and when do those benefits peak in terms of time as well?
Well, look, bragging about it is a blessing and a curse at the same time, right? It's like on the mountain. You don't want to be overconfident, but mm-hmm. you want to be smart as well. So there is a sweet spot. There is a threshold. If I plot your benefits on a graph, then the blood flow starts when you get in, when you get into an ice bath. Your heart rate shoots up, but then it comes down after 40 seconds. Now, you do want to make sure that you're at the highest level of energy generation, which is what keeps the blood flow, but also what reduces the inflammation and also regulates all a lot of your hormone levels. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point in time, you stop getting benefits. So we always say the sweet spot is no matter what temperature you're going in at, definitely you're not getting in at 15 to 20. You're getting in at between 5 and 10 degrees. No matter what degree you're in, if you do more than 17 to 18 minutes, then there is a threshold where the body stops. Some people need it because our fat complexion, our fat complexity, the composition is actually different. And remember, there are a whole range of mental benefits of why people do it. We don't always get athletes in longevity. A lot of people that have insomnia, stress-related problems, anxiety, they come to us because they want to regulate all of that. And this is where you release a lot of the toxicity in the body. So there are different protocols, different needs, and different
We are going to continue this because I want to find out more about that mental side. Also, in terms of the breath work involved, why is that such a crucial part of cold water immersion? Danny Afuani is with us today, founder of Longevity Wellness. We've stolen away from a very busy day of ice baths, probably due for his fourth one around 4 o'clock. He's here until then. Talking ice baths, there's been a bit of controversy around the Dutch motivational speaker and extreme athlete Wim Hof, known as the Iceman, and some cases, some families claiming their loved ones have died performing some of his breathing methods or a similar technique with cold water therapy. So we're talking today, joining us from Longevity Wellness Hub is the founder, Danny. And I wanted to ask you, because we are seeing a lot of companies jumping on the bandwagon and perhaps not having good practice. So if someone has signed up for a session, it's gone along to a facility, what are some of the red flags that this really isn't being done responsibly?
So first of all, have the curiosity to do a little bit of research online and read about what you should and should not be doing. Do everything in moderation. You're going to stay here the next day and the day after, so maybe have some curiosity to start at a certain level. And ask for your breath work.
Now, can you explain what you mean by breath work? I did some recently with actually a Wim Hof trained facilitator here in Dubai. And it blew my mind. It absolutely blew my mind. I could feel like energy traveling up and down my body. I was on another planet. And then we did the cold water after that. It's not a case of get out of your car and get into a wheelie bin full of ice.
You do want to raise your adrenaline before you get into an ice bath. But also, you do want to make sure that you're breathing properly because breathing is what warms you up. And you do want to make sure that you get enough oxygen. And you also want to make sure that you are protecting yourself before you go into an ice bath environment, which is a shock environment. Mm-hmm. So breathing is very important. And there are different levels of breathing. So you should ask the question about what kind of breathing you're doing. Because, you know, if you do some certain levels of breath work, you can go all the way to DMT, right? But what you do want to do, what you want to do is make sure that you're asking questions about proper breath work and that you're learning about what that breath work does. So I research everything before I go and do it. And I think everyone should have the curiosity to ask questions and learn because you're doing something new.
We had an amazing expert on the show last week and he was saying, you are the CEO of your own health. And I was like, absolutely right. Danny, while you're here, I'm just curious about the other things that you do with longevity in mind. You talked before about kind of acupressure as such, the nail bed that you're standing on in the morning, cold water immersion. What else is on your list, whether it's food or supplement, mindset? Obviously, exercise is a big thing for you as an endurance athlete. What else could we learn from you?
Well, I've discovered that if you actually be disciplined in terms of taking your own well-being charge if you take own charge of your own well-being, you can actually live well and age better. And so that includes a couple of modalities. And that's what we're doing at Longevity. we quantum scan someone to tell them, to give them a wealth of information about their body.
What is a quantum scan? It sounds like we're being, you know, Stanley Kubrick, you know, space odysseys.
Well, what I love today about technology and tying up with the best medical institutions around the world is that today, just by gathering evidence from around your skin and your voice tones, we can actually tell you what's happening from an organ perspective, a hormonal composition perspective, food allergy perspective, nutrition perspective, heavy metals, toxins. And we can actually connect you with our partners in terms of supplements and provide you with what you're lacking. Because today the strategy is not to overload you with supplements, but to only give you what you're lacking so you can thrive. And then we can put you on a program, whether it's a training program or a recovery program, to use a hyperbaric chamber oxygen, a hyperbaric oxygen chamber, or for example, our red light technology or our ice bath technology or our sauna technology. These are modalities that have been proven for you to be able to not only look after your physical being, but also look after your emotional being.
Got questions for you. We might need to skip a song. Yes, Message is saying, what are the boards called that you and your guests were talking about at the start? What are the benefits? So you do like a nail board. I do one which is more like an acupressure mat. But I do the kind of the slightly weaker version. What are some of the benefits that you've experienced? And I guess what the science says as well, Danny.
Well, the first thing is that, you know, your feet and your calf, they say that they're the next heart and your other heart and your physical being. So physiologically, what's happening is that you're shooting up the blood flow in an insane way. And that makes you feel really good, but it also raises your adrenaline levels. But it also controls cortisol. Mm-hmm. So it's a different way of controlling cortisol. And it just shows you to the genius of how much genius your body is when you actually stand on nails and witness the things and the fear threshold and the boundaries that you can cross by doing that. And I would really advise everyone to do it. And this is the thing that you can really realize that, oh, I'm not going to be able to do it. But if you're persistent enough and you're disciplined enough and you do it, you can be fearless over your mind and your body. And then you can take it on from there.
Sadhu is the one that you mentioned before. So it's
Sadhu board.
S-A-D-H-U. So give that a little Google. Also the message going, what about sauna then ice bath? Is that a good idea? So
100%.
Yeah?
100%.
Which order? Does it matter?
There's only one order in my school.
Go on.
And it's you detoxify first and you remove the sweat from your body, and this is how you detoxify, and then you recover and you reboot, right?
So hot then cold.
Hot then cold. Now, some schools say that you need to follow your body cycle, which means your body at night is getting ready to rest.
So you do cold and then hot, and that would kind of calm
you? No, so I would say do hot because it's going to calm you down and detoxify you. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, jump in cold water, not for 10 minutes, but maybe for 3 minutes. Don't shock yourself so that, mm-hmm. you know. But in my belief system, it's one order. Because if you jump in a sauna after an ice bath, you're circumventing all of these benefits that are happening. That's what I believe in.
I've had lots of people asking for your details as well. So with your permission, if people want to send me the word health, can I share the longevity Instagram account? Would that be okay?
With pleasure.
And one last question. If we're going to do one great thing to help us live longer, and I don't want to be like, you know, some old crone living to 120. I want to live well until the end. What would you love everyone listening today to do, to change, to avoid, to adjust?
Well, I would say spend more time with yourself, because when I went into mountain expeditions and I met myself really, I was able to empty what I call today the bag analogy. Your mind is a bag. There's so much it's going to fit. So meet yourself, become fearless over your mind and your body, and you're going to discover so many benefits. But know about your mental being, your emotional being, mm-hmm. and your physical being. Reduce inflammation, control your stress, and if you do those, and you know you don't feel well, then I don't know what I'm talking about. But I've broken through, and I'll tell you with all confidence that at 43, I feel younger than when I was in my 20s.
Well,
and stronger.
I turned 42 on Friday, so you and I are going to have a chat now. Danny, yes, thank you so much. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.